From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about the origins of Atlas Obscura and some of the thousands of places they've uncovered through their book and website. Then cellist Robert Cohen talks about his work as a classical musician and how audiences respond to him on tour.
This is the thing, you know, that about traveling. People really do appreciate that you've done that, that you've traveled so far to give a gift, the gift of music.
And film contributor Dave Lurson talks about Lucy in the Sky, a movie inspired by the true story of astronaut Lisa Novak, who was charged with attempted kidnapping in 2007.
I think if you would have had, or the director would have cast someone lesser than Natalie Portman, it could have been a really terrible movie, actually. Her and the supporting cast really do serve to elevate it beyond what it might have been.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The website Atlas Obscura, which showcases the world's quirkiest wonders, has only been around for a decade. But in that time, the company has visited and cataloged almost 20,000 places. Minnesota native and lifelong explorer Dylan Thuris is one of the co-founders of Atlas Obscura. The author and filmmaker will be at UW-Milwaukee's American Geographical Society Library this Wednesday for a presentation about the second print edition of Atlas Obscura, an explorer's guide to the world's hidden wonders. He joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North by Skype to discuss the creation of the company.
In some ways, I cite the real inspiration as happening in Wisconsin when I was about 12 years old. Because I grew up in Minnesota and I went on all these road trips with my parents. And on one of these road trips, you know, we went to Wall Drug and the Corn Palace and all of that kind of stuff. But we also stopped at, in Spring Green, Wisconsin, the House on the Rock. It always amazes me that most people have never heard of it, although if you're from Wisconsin, likely you're familiar, which is this wild, crazy, giant sort of house series of warehouses and rooms filled with everything from the world's largest carousel to a squid fighting a whale sculpture the size of the Statue of Liberty. And as a 12-year-old, I distinctly remember feeling like, if this is what's in the woods in Wisconsin, what else is out there? So from that time, I had always been kind of interested in this kind of unusual travel. It's what I like to do. But it wasn't until I was, you know, older in my early mid-20s that I met my co-founder, Joshua Foer, and we started talking about making a website where you could actually kind of add all these special, incredible places and other people could come and submit their own places. And that was really how the Atlas Obscura was born. It was born as a website in 2009. And we just said, this is the kind of things that we love to find in the world, these, you know, small museums, outsider art projects. And you tell us what amazing hidden wonders you think deserve to be celebrated. So that's what it's been.
And so how do you decide? There are probably as many wonderful hidden wonder things in the world as there are people, you know. So how do you winnow down that list?
I think the actual sort of number of places may be close to infinite. I think you're right. It's really about how you look at a place in a lot of ways. And there is no one set of criteria. It's a little bit, you know it when you see it. You are looking for something that has an element of surprise that makes you feel like the world is a little bigger than you had previously thought, a little stranger. And so we just take it place by place. We see what people submit to us. We read kind of the story, the angle. We look at the photos and you know, do all of our fact checking and reporting work. And then we decide this place really deserves to be in Atlas Obscura.
Well, you know, the House on the Rock also figured into Neil Gaiman's work too.
Absolutely. He knows a good a place that is so fantastical, it's hard to believe. I remember in an interview, he said, I actually tamed it down a little bit for the book because if I wrote it as was true, no one yes. would believe it.
It was American Gods, right?
That's right. Yeah, which I love that book.
Me too. It's a phenomenal book. And, you know, so that's like two people who've mentioned, you know, House on the Rock. And for people who think that that's made up, it really isn't. You know, it's there. And of course, I'm looking at the map of Wisconsin in the book right now. And of course, just sort of northeast of that is another fabulous Wisconsin thing, which is Dr. Evermore's Forevertron.
Truly, truly. And one of the things that I think is actually so interesting about both The House on the Rock and Dr. Evermore's Forevertron, because Dr. Evermore actually was part of building The House on the Rock, is that there was this kind of, you would call them like an artist collective now, like an installation art collective, basically operating in Wisconsin in the 1960s, 1970s, doing all of this kind of crazy, amazing sculptural work, fabrication work. They just didn't couch themselves as fine artists, so it was never kind of framed that way. But really, that's what was going on. I mean, Dr. Evermore and Sid Boyum and all of the guys who worked on House on the Rock, Alex Jordan, were all kind of like really pioneering. I mean, now there's groups out in like Meow Wolf, which is a giant arts collective that has a not in some ways a sort of similar kind of space out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You know, is very hip and. But these guys doing this work in Wisconsin were way, way, way ahead. And Dr. Evermore's Forevertron is this amazing sculptural space filled with all kinds of enormous machines and metal bars kind of welded into creatures and spaceships. And
it's supposed to heal you, too.
Yes, that's right. And there's something about time travel involved.
Yes, I think there is. Yeah. Well, and Wisconsin and the upper Midwest seem to be a perfect place for an Atlas Obscura type publication because there's so much. Oh, I moved here from the East Coast almost 14 years ago now. And when I got here, just the art installations across the state, it's like there's a lot of really eccentric creative people who made their homes here. And you think, wow, really? It was a long winter, I guess.
I guess there are certain places in the world that seem to be these kind of focal points of just a certain kind of offbeat creativity. It's a kind of creativity that doesn't put on airs. It's not about being, I'm a very fancy artist. It's just like, look, I had a shop and I decided to fill it with little dioramas of anthropomorphic taxidermy where all the animals are playing cards and boxing each other. I'm actually referring to a place called the Moccasin Bar in Hayward, Wisconsin, which is one of my all-time favorite bars. And it's just all of Wisconsin and much of the Midwest is like this. But there's something in the water, something in the air.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about Atlas Obscura, too, is that it's not just human-made things. There's a lot of natural, nature-made things that make up part of this, too. And I just happened to, as I'm sitting here, open the book randomly to, what page am I on? 426. And we're in Mexico. And it's the Hierve el Agua. And it's the freshwater pool topping off what appears to be a frozen waterfall. I had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, we try and when we were comprising Atlas, you know, we realized right away, first we wanted to gather things that had been left out of traditional guidebooks. So that was sort of maybe there were some abandoned kind of sites that were like that. There are these kind of outsider artist things or kind of quirky roadside things. But there's also a lot of natural phenomenon that, you know, deserves to be celebrated and is really, truly incredible. And we try and include a lot of those as well. There's one in upper Minnesota that I particularly love called Devil's Kettle. A river flows and then splits into two waterfalls, and one kind of goes on normally, and the other goes into this kettle, into this, you know, rock formation, and just disappears. Basically, no one really is sure what happens after that. They're not sure how it formed because the rock is kind of not the right rock to dissolve in this way, and they're just not sure where it actually ever lets out from the Devil's Kettle. So it's this little fun natural mystery in northern Minnesota.
Yeah, I was. I actually was looking at that page not too long ago, and I was thinking, well, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. The Great Lakes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it does. But the idea that it's just impossible to trace, or it seems to be, is really fascinating. Do you think that because the world in a lot of ways has gotten smaller, because we're so interconnected now in a way that 19th century explorers weren't and couldn't be, that books and websites like Atlas Obscura play a role in helping us find the wonders of the world when we think we've seen it all?
I think that's right. I think what's ironic is the world does feel small now. We know what's happening in every corner of the globe in some ways, or we think we do. And, you know, all this information is at our fingertips. But in reality, the world is still very, very, very big and filled with more things than we can ever imagine. And so I think part of the point of Ars Obscura, the sort of almost like the spiritual mission of it, is to remind people that the world is this surprising, wondrous place, that it has not all been done, that not everything is some strip mall or some chain store. Like, sure, you see that everywhere you go in the world now. But if you dig a little deeper, you'll find such truly tremendous places and people. And that's our goal, is to give people that feeling, that kind of transcendent sense when you are traveling and you see something, you go, wow, really incredible that this exists and that I'm here and can experience it.
Right. There's something about travel that if you're open to it and not complaining about how things aren't the same as they are at home, that it opens you up in a way that that almost nothing else does, at least in my experience. If you just arrive somewhere you've never been, and maybe you don't speak the language, and maybe you don't know, you know, which side people are driving on and all of that, but you just sort of open yourself up to it, it changes you in a really fundamental way.
Yeah, I call it seeing with new eyes. And I think there's like, it can be done locally. Like, you can kind of force yourself to approach things with that same sense of openness and curiosity. But travel is just such a shortcut. All the little changes, all the differences, your brain actually snaps sort of on it. Everything that you've been cheating at, where your brain has been ignoring because it sees it and already knows what to expect and what's there. And so you're not actually really taking it in. Your brain has to kind of go, oh, wait, I'm not familiar with any of this. The street signs are different. The stoplights are different. Even the trash cans are different. And so suddenly it's like someone popped a set of new eyeballs in your head. And like, you notice every little thing. And it's a really wonderful experience. And in a way, it's a lesson about how we should try and look at the world as much as possible, traveling or not.
Right. Being aware and open to everyday experience wherever you are. Yeah. And you're right. It's harder when you're in your routine. And,
totally.
Yeah. And so, you know, books and websites like the Atlas Obscura, you know, help you do that. And I have to say, I didn't open this up this far before we started talking today, but I got to the back of the book to Buckminster Fuller's Dymaxion Map. And
oh, yeah.
I think of Buckminster Fuller, and he was this eccentric inventor and I would say a genius.
I love him.
Me too. And yet I had no idea this map existed. And can you explain what it is? Because it's beautiful, but it might not be what you think it is.
He wanted to solve a particular problem, which is that all maps are essentially lies, because you have to take a sphere and mash it down into a flat space. And so, you know, every Mercator map we look at, the map that's in every classroom, it's the Greenland problem, right? Greenland has gotten enormous on this map, and Africa is actually quite a bit sort of smaller relative to the other continents than it should be. And so he thought, okay, what's the closest sort of object to a sphere? And he thought an icosahedron, a 20-sided polyhedron, or basically if you've ever seen a 20-sided dice, it's that shape. And what if I mapped the globe onto this and then just unfolded it and laid that flat? And so that's basically what he did. So in doing so, he also rearranged all the continents, because you can unfold it along any given seam. And it's just this incredible way of rethinking the relationship between space, between the continents. And so it's my favorite. It's absolutely my favorite map projection is his Dymaxion map.
Then it makes you realize how much we think of the world through the maps that we're familiar with, that's what we think the world is and what it should look like and what is north and what is south and what, you know, which continents are bigger or smaller and what the relationships are. And I'm reminded of a West Wing episode where they turn the Mercator map upside down, because why not?
Sure.
It's perfectly valid. And everyone freaks out. It's like, that's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. And because it is, because we're trained to look at it a certain way.
That's right. And when the particular, you can unfold it in any way, but Bucky was really quite fond of one unfolding, which basically every continent is connected to every other continent, which is really great. When you look at it, you don't think about North America being connected to Asia and Russia, but we, of course, are over the Bering Strait. So, you know, when you start to see that there's this almost unending thread that connects the whole world, it really changes the way you think about space and even about how you might travel. You know, you think, oh, maybe what if I did a trip up the West Coast, hopped over the Bering Strait and down the coast of Russia. So that would be a hard trip to do for various
reasons. It might be hard for a lot of reasons, but boy, what a great trip. That would be fantastic.
Exactly.
End up in Japan, but that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Precisely.
Exactly. So I have to ask you, are there trips that you've taken since you started doing this? Are there trips that you've taken because of the research that you've done?
Oh, every trip I take is because of the research we've done. Every single place we go, I end up visiting an Atlas site. It has completely shaped all of our travel. And it's also given me the chance to take a couple of really grand scale trips that have been amazing. Josh and I took a trip down to South America a number of years back and went to the last Incan bridge, also called the Quechua Chaca, basically this bridge woven out of grass in rural Peru that is rewoven every year because it sort of rots. It's organic material. And it's made in the exact same way that it was during the Incan Empire. It's even though each year the bridge is totally new, it's also this unbroken cultural, historical connection to the Incan Empire. And so it's just seeing places like that. Actually, Josh and I are taking a trip coming up soon. We're helping guide one of our group trips to Turkmenistan to visit a place called the Gates of Hell. And Josh and I have been talking about, you know, we used to sort of joke with each other back when this was like a project being run out of my kitchen and say, you know, when we make it, we'll have a beer at the edge of the Gates of Hell. Well, a decade later, we are actually going to have a beer at the edge of the Gates of Hell, which is, to clarify what I'm talking about, is a giant 250-foot wide hole in the Turkmenistan desert that has been on fire for 45 years. And so that is a trip that I'm really looking forward to going on. And so absolutely. And you know, even when I'm visiting home in Minneapolis, it's shown me new things. I grew up maybe a couple of miles from this place called Orfield Labs, and I never knew what it was, and it didn't look particularly interesting. But it turns out to have contained the world's quietest room, a room that had the lowest, it had like a negative 20 decibel rating. So you'd go and you'd sit in this little sound chamber, and over time, as your ears attenuated to the space, you would start to like hear the internal workings of your own body, because there was literally no other sound to fill that space. So your ears suddenly started picking up on things that you'd never heard before. And at one point I raised my eyebrows and I could hear the sound. And so that was 2 miles from the home that I grew up in. And so that sensation of being reminded that wonders can be incredibly close at hand, that you really don't know what's sort of just in your own backyard, it has been such an ongoing gift of doing this work.
So if there's one piece of advice you could offer a wannabe traveler, what would it be?
I think the piece of advice I would offer is to start where you are, to stop thinking about travel as getting on a plane and flying around the world. That is great and it's wonderful. But if you go at it, you do some research, you sort of set your mind around what is intriguing to you, what stories you want to tell or learn more about, you can travel a 100-mile radius out from your home and find absolutely unbelievable things. So I would tell people to put on their kind of hat of curiosity, their hat of I am an explorer, and look in their own backyard. And I think people are surprised by what they find there.
Well, we are so looking forward to having you here. Dylan Thuris, it has been such a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dylan Thuris is the co-founder and artistic director of AtlasObscura.com, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. The second edition of the Atlas Obscura book is out now. Thuris will be at UW-Milwaukee's American Geographical Society Library this Wednesday evening at 6:30 as part of the company's trivia book tour. Coming up, cellist Robert Cohen joins us for our monthly segment called On That Note. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every month, cellist Robert Cohen joins us to talk about the life of a touring classical musician. It's a life he knows well. He's been performing professionally for decades. But as he tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North, it can be hard, balancing the constant touring, practicing, teaching, and performing.
At the moment, I'm just back for a few hours, and, you know, those hours are so pressurized. There's so many things to do. I've just literally, for instance, flown back to London in order to greet my new students at the Royal Academy of Music. And I wanted them to feel that I was there for them at the beginning of their studies and not to feel that I was the kind of person, the missing teacher. And, you know, aren't we supposed to meet him and have cello lessons? So I definitely wanted to, you know, to rush back and make this time just to help set them up and make them feel that this is the beginning of the next part of their lives, you know. And so, of course, that means that I've had to push things in all directions to make that time. So I've flown in from one festival in Slovakia, which was really demanding from the repertoire, the music I had to play, and working with new people and all the kind of things that we've talked about many times, those pressures that you have as a professional musician, you know, working with people, finding ways to make music with people, and all the emotional side of that, and also the emotional side of performing great music, which, you know, takes a lot out of you, then rushing around, getting on flights, seeing new people. And then tomorrow morning, really early, I've got to fly off to Italy and then to Switzerland and so on. And I think, you know, you just feel a lot of pressure, not so much from the fact that there are so many things to do, but the fact that there's so much music that you want to focus on and is really demanding. And I'm realizing in my old age now that I really value the experience that I've had over the years of how to cope and how to be able to arrive at a rehearsal, arrive at a concert, and really lift my game, despite the fact that I might be exhausted, despite the fact that there are so many pressures around it. And I think that's kind of been years and years of training of how to focus really well, how to find a kind of seriously deep focus, even if it's just for a few minutes of work in your mind with the music, or taking the cello and working on a small section or a piece of music, knowing that you've got kind of a few minutes here or there to work on it, but making that really count.
So when you are looking at your schedule and trying to spread things out over a year, the following year, I know you tend to work a couple to 3 years in advance. And so how do you make those choices? You know, to say, that's just going to be too much. I would love to do that, whatever that is, but four other things are happening at different parts of the globe, far too close to make that happen. I mean, how do you say no?
Well, I mean, funnily enough, of course, you know, the typical thing is that you've got something that you really want to do, and it's on the 23rd of November, 2023. And there's nothing really around that. You know, you've got no other bookings around that time. And somebody else then contacts you and says, do you happen to be available on the 23rd of November? and then you're in that, oh, couldn't you choose another date? And no, we couldn't, you know. So that does actually happen. It's ridiculous how that happens, but it's true. But I think, you know, when you say around the globe, that is becoming very much more an issue for me, because I feel now that flying all over the place is not really what I should be doing, honestly, Bonnie. I'm honestly feeling that, first of all, if I can possibly go by train or something like that, I will do that. And that, of course, takes more time. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that, okay, this is my work and it's my life, but, you know, maybe it's just not always the right thing to make a decision to fly across the world to do something when, okay, there'll be something else that maybe ties in better, is, you know, geographically a better choice at a different time. And so I am definitely sort of saying, thank you so much for asking me for that. But can we, you know, can we do it another time? Can we do it a time when I'm already in Asia or I'm already somewhere else? And so that, you know, I'm literally not burning Aerojet fuel constantly, because I just think that, you know, we all need to think about these things now.
You know, there are times when I long for the return of the ocean-going liners, where you could take 6 days to get across the Atlantic and longer to get across the Pacific, that there was time in our schedules to allow for that, both in terms of, you know, helping the environment, but also in helping ourselves and not be so crushed with fatigue from jet lag. You know, I don't tend to look backward with fondness very much, but that's one of the things that I wish we could resurrect.
Yeah, and if we can't do it exactly like that, I mean, talking about the being under pressure and being in the middle of things and the fatigue and so on, and the energy required to do what you need to do, and what you learn and how to conserve. I feel that I've learned very much over the years how to look after myself, or at least how to help my wife look after me really well, in terms of, you know, in terms of my energy, of my fitness and my physical well-being, because of the strain of all of this traveling. And, you know, for sure, to go to airports and get in those lines and be in unhealthy situations and in that metal tube in the sky with all those other people with lots of germs. You know, you're continually fighting in your body those situations and the stresses and the jet lag. And certainly I feel that I've learned a lot over the years in how to be fitter and how to be stronger, more resilient, I suppose, so that, you know, I'm in perhaps better shape now to perform than I was even in my 20s, when I just think I just threw myself into it and I would get exhausted and not worry about it. Now I'm probably much more careful and better at applying my energy. And I have to say that I think a lot of that knowledge has come about through helping others, by helping my students and other people that I, other musicians that I meet and teach on in the summer courses and so on. Because I've noticed that people of my age of 60, of my colleagues, a lot of them have really suffered from that strenuous life and that lack of real understanding of how they're going to cope physically in the long run. And they kind of reach a kind of burnout point. And then that gives them a lot of stress, because in order to perform as they want, when their bodies are kind of saying, hey, hey, you know, you're really not in great shape to do this now, then they fight that. And
it causes more tension.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that musicians are able to do that, say, dancers, for the most part, can't, is you can continue to play at the top of your game in your 60s. Most dancers are not dancing in their 60s. Most of them aren't dancing in their 40s. And so musicians like yourself have to learn how to balance all of these competing demands and keep the level of technique and musicianship at its highest level. And I feel, and now I'm sounding like a curmudgeon, but I feel that as the pace of the world has speeded up, it's become harder and harder to do what you talked about earlier, which is carve out that time for deep focus, even if it's only for a couple of minutes, because I think that's so important, and it's really important as we get older too.
It's something that I worry about, because certainly, you know, in the midst of everything, it does concern me that when I arrive tomorrow in Italy, that I'm going to have the right amount of energy to deal with a new situation, to meet new people, to start rehearsing, to, you know, sleep in a strange bed, and so on. And in advance of that, that is a concern, because, you know, I know that I've already been doing that for the last 3 weeks continuously. So in the back of my mind, that there's that, is this going to be okay? Am I going to cope with this? I do still want to get up then. I still want to be able to play as well as I possibly can. So that's in the back of your mind. But at the same time, you know, you're thinking about the music and how that's going to work. and focusing on that. And you again force yourself in a way to focus in that way, to fulfill your own desires. And maybe because of all this pushing yourself and this arriving on the platform and playing, and hopefully then fulfilling at least some of what you really love, that you've created a new energy for yourself and you become kind of fitter and stronger again. So it somehow does feed you. And maybe this is why musicians stay young very often, because they're pushing themselves, but they're also feeding themselves with this fantastic experience of performing and of being creative and communicating and so on. And it refreshes you in a way that is constantly unexpected, because you can feel completely and utterly shattered and exhausted after that performance. But somehow the thoughts of the next music will drive you on despite the next series of practical stresses and so on. It's quite amazing.
It is quite amazing. And I'm thinking it's in a good way the end justifies the means.
Yeah. And even hear myself speaking this way, I'm kind of thinking, gosh, you get still so excited about it after all these years.
Well, and that's what we hope for, you know, despite all of the crushing pressure and, you know, the rushing off to one end of the globe and the other. I mean, I'm thinking as far as you going to Italy, it's only 1 hour time difference. So it's not as horrible as coming here or going to Asia or something like that. So, you know, you might find that you'll be fine. You'll get there and you'll get a little sleep and everything. But, you know, I just have to say, I'm really glad that you and so many other wonderful musicians are still willing to do this, because it gives us, the audience, an opportunity to hear something that we would not hear otherwise. And
well, this is true. Actually, this is the thing, you know, that about traveling, people really do appreciate that you've done that, that you've traveled so far to give a gift, the gift of music. It is a beautiful thing when people say, come and speak to you afterwards and say, you know, it's incredible you've come so far to do this and we really appreciate it. And I suppose that's an extra bonus for them in a way, isn't it? That, of course, they might love their musicians from around them, from their country to play, and probably there are incredible musicians who are giving concerts in their own country. But when somebody comes from somewhere else, there is some kind of frisson. There's something about the fact that we're pulling the world together that way. And I think that does excite people. And I appreciate that.
Pulling the world together one note at a time. Well, Robert, have a very safe trip. Try to get some rest, you know, drink a lot of water, you know, eat well, you know, do all of those things. And we will look forward to hearing about Italy and all of the other concerts in the next month when we speak next.
Lovely. Great to speak to you, Bonnie.
Cellist Robert Cohen is a regular Lake Effect contributor, and he joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North every month for a segment we call On That Note. You can listen to some of our past conversations with Cohen at WUWM.com. Like Cohen, Lake Effect essayist J.F. Reardon travels a lot for work. And as she explains in her essay, The Perils of Public Music, she'd just like a little peace and quiet on the road.
There used to be a lot of mockery about Muzak, that bland public music that took popular tunes like I Can't Get No Satisfaction, removed the drums, and added violins and a zither. Its mediocrity was intended to soothe, but for people who actually like music, it served mostly to irritate. I don't know if Muzak still exists, but if the corporate entity has faded, its inane heritage carries on with a vengeance. Public music wears on the nerves. Airlines have decided that their passengers want to hear it as they get on and off the plane. Perhaps they believe that the hostilities taking place as passengers hunt for space to stow their carry-ons will be somehow mitigated by jazz. Unwilling to participate in this ritual combat, I always check my bags, take my seat as quickly as possible to get out of the scrum, and have the leisure to watch what's going on around me. I admit to being amused by the contrast between the activities just overhead and the saxophone music. If the music is an attempt to create the impression that everyone's having a good time, it's a fail. But maybe the airline executives have a previously unsuspected sense of humor. Hotels play music in their public spaces, and the selections are clearly chosen to set the correct tone of fashionableness and chic. At the last place I stayed, iced in while the airport was closed for 2 days, the effect was surreal. A colleague described it as Bollywood on acid. Even at 4 a.m, during a discussion with a desk clerk over whether the gym was open, the empty lobby resonated with a strange undulating sound that created a vague feeling of nausea. In the public rooms outside of a conference, the tinkling sound of wind chimes and synthesized chanting interferes with serious thinking and creates a mental discord between the reality of work and the unattainability of vacation. At resort hotels, the soothing sound of surf is covered up by the incessant beat of techno-funk amplified at the beach. Inside the hotel lobby, however, you can hear the sound of waves, but only embedded in the Tibetan chimes of corporate spa music. Travel, particularly business travel, is stressful. You're away from home and family and dogs. The TSA has put its hands all over yourself and your stuff. Your feet hurt. You packed for the wrong climate. You haven't finished writing your speech when the leading expert on the topic will be on the panel. Your flight is delayed, and you may miss a conference call with your boss. Your cell phone battery is low. You are breathing stale air from planes, airports, and hotel conference rooms. You're eating unhealthy food, and the gym was closed when you tried to work out. The airport announcements blare at you, and neon signs invite you to eat bad things and spend money on stuff you don't really need. At times like these, you need your thoughts to yourself. So, a word to people who control the volume. Just turn it off. Please.
Wisconsin writer J.F. Reardon is author of the North of the Tension Line series of novels set on Washington Island. Her latest book is a series of essays called Reflections on a Life in Exile. Reardon read her essay, The Perils of Public Music. Coming up, we're joined by film contributor Dave Lurson, who shares his thoughts about the new film, Lucy in the Sky. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
Just feel a little off. No, not off. It's more... You know how it is. You go up there, you see everything. The whole universe. And everything here looks so small. We're so small. And then you splash down, what, you go to Applebee's, you know, Monday Night Football, clip your toenails. And all you can think about is,
when can I go back?
That was Natalie Portman, Tig Notaro, and Jeffrey Donovan in the new film Lucy in the Sky. The three play astronauts, members of a select club of people who have experienced life outside of Earth. The film tells the story of the fictional Lucy Cola, one of the first female astronauts to venture into space, and her return to Earth, readjusting to life beneath the stars. Lucy in the Sky is loosely inspired by the real-life story of astronaut Lisa Novak, who infamously drove from Houston to Orlando with the intent of kidnapping the girlfriend of a man with whom she was having an affair. The film is directed by Noah Hawley and stars John Hamm, Ellen Burstyn, and Nick Offerman, among other well-respected actors. In fact, film contributor Dave Lurson says the cast was the only saving grace of the film and prevented it from burning in the atmosphere. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in studio to discuss more of his thoughts.
Well, it's very much a tabloid story. I mean, I guess the reality of it, if news accounts are accurate, are very tabloid-ish. And I think the storyline of the movie comes across that way. I mean, there's an inherent tension here, which may reflect reality or not. I mean, you have the idea of women who are astronauts now. That would have been, inconceivable 50 years ago to most people. So on the other hand, you have a woman who's fulfilling the worst female stereotypes of crazy, bonkers emotional response to a man who rejects her. And she's an astronaut. Well, I guess that could happen. But if you're looking for a strong female empowerment message in this movie, I think it's a mixed message at best.
I agree. And it's interesting because I think had any other actress done it, maybe it would have not remained a mixed message. But I think Natalie Portman is a strong actor. And personally, I've usually and always enjoy the work she's doing. What did you think of her performance and being able to, be the foundation of carrying this story despite how we know it's kind of going to turn out?
Well, the strength of the movie is the cast overall. I began noticing Natalie Portman from the beginning of her career, I guess, with The Phantom Menace. And I think that she's a remarkable actor who, in this role, pushes herself into another area. I've never lived in Texas. I've been there, though. I mean, I think she got the accent down and the cadence of speech, which is one thing. She brings the character as written to life very strongly. And I think that the supporting cast was quite well chosen and well directed. So I would say that the director of this film, who is mostly known for television work, Fargo, some of the stuff I've enjoyed, but his quirky trick bag of stuff that he does seems a little bit adventurous on the small screen. On the big screen, I don't think it worked particularly well.
Yeah, directed by Noah Hawley. As you mentioned, he's known for Legion and Fargo, and this is his debut feature film. You mentioned some of the tricks used by the first-time filmmaker. I thought, for me, it intrigued me and caught my attention. Perhaps I wouldn't feel the same way if I saw the movie a second time, but I was a big fan, particularly of the cinematographer, Polly Morgan.
Well, the movie looked beautiful at points. One of the things that was disappointing to me, if I think about films like 2001 or Gravity, the character Natalie Portman plays is supposed to be bowled over by the immensity of the celestial cosmos. And I see it in her eyes, but I didn't feel it watching the movie.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
Yeah, I think the movie didn't really deliver on that.
What did you think of, it didn't quite get to full fishbowl, but there was a lot of satellite imagery, even in scenes on the ground, not just in space, kind of keeping in mind Lucy's perspective of the Earth. We had blurry edges that would get more and more close to the center as the movie progressed. There was a lot of shifting of aspect ratios, things like that. Do you think it was a way to supplement or maybe a tool to lead the story towards that teetering edge, before we get to the point where Lucy, quote, breaks?
I don't know. I didn't really feel that way while watching the movie. I guess if I wore a watch, I would have been looking at it constantly after about 20 minutes. Because I found the film itself to be kind of boring to watch, even while the cast was performing very well. So to me, there is something not quite working with the filmmaking of it. And maybe it's just I'm troubled by the story in some ways. And maybe I think if you would have had or the director would have cast someone lesser than Natalie Portman, it could have been a really terrible movie, actually. I think that her and the supporting cast really do serve to elevate it beyond what it might have been.
Right. I think the movie did start off pretty strong at first. As you mentioned, perhaps we didn't feel it through the cinematography as much. But the whole movie is all about how experiencing the cosmos, how going up into space, which obviously very few people here on Earth can empathize with, and how that affects you coming down. I feel like it wanted to start off very sophisticated and all symbolic of that, mm-hmm. and wanting to make us sympathize with Lucy a little more. Not quite say blame her for her actions, like blame it on space, mm-hmm. per se, but it also highlights just inherent things that women know well, and especially during this time in NASA, just the workplace sexism. You know, how much harder she had to work to be a part of missions, to feel like she constantly had to prove herself after coming back down to Earth, and the rejection of not being accepted on missions and, quote, being too emotional, how that affects someone as well.
Well, I mean, we hear things in the news quite often lately about this, the power relationship of men still in many workplaces. I mean, essentially, it looks as if, you know, the male lead in the film, her romantic interest, blocked her promotion, so to speak, or blocked her ability to go on the next mission, choosing instead the woman that he preferred to be with. So I think that's going on. One of the strengths of the movie, I think, is the way it portrays the unique kind of bonding that can occur among groups of people who have a unique experience. I would imagine that the handful of people who've been in space hang out together and bowl, and you know, I mean, because they have something to share with each other that other people really wouldn't be able to understand in quite the same way.
Exactly. How do you think this film stands compared to other films centered on the astronaut experience? You know, our most recent one that I was thinking of, you know, for First Man, Ryan Gosling playing Neil Armstrong, you know, that was a more introspective look at how that can affect a person. And going into this blind, I was hoping, you know, okay, maybe this will be a woman's perspective in the same manner. Obviously, it's a little bit different because of the story that it evolves into. But where do you think it stands on trying to get audiences to even get a hint of what people go through?
Well, I think it gives a hint. Again, I think it falls short of really bringing us the experience of it when you compare it to some of the greater, you know, movies made in the past, even the recent past, about space exploration, human space exploration. You know, there's a glimpse of it, a whiff of it there. But, I mean, the movie is really more about, you know, her experiences back on Earth. And she is wrestling with somehow, you know, it's all so small seeming to me now after seeing this. And so why does that lead to, you know, the unraveling of her marriage and her, I mean, I don't know. I don't think the movie really fulfills its objectives in that area.
Do you think part of that has to do with screenwriting? Or, again, is it a flaw of just, like, what the story is based on?
Well, I think what the story is based on is you know, doubtful material. I mean, again, I remember hearing about this incident in the news, and I never followed up on it, so I don't really know what really happened there. I couldn't help but thinking, well, you know, why don't you make a more biographical film about it then, instead of fictionalizing it, you know, and then get rid of the stupid name Lucy in the Sky. Lucy was not the name of the real astronaut, so you think that Beatles fans might mistake it for a documentary and buy a ticket. I mean, what's the point of that? I mean, there's just a lot of things that were just not quite there with this film.
You mentioned the supporting cast. We had Dan Stevens, Pearl Amanda Dickinson, Ellen Burstyn, John Hamm, Tig Notaro, Nick Offerman even. I do agree that it elevates the film in that way. Do you think that this film can both be sensitive and sensationalist? Do you think that's what it was kind of going for? Because I feel like it takes an abrupt turn once we get to the point where, okay, this is similar to the news story we've all heard.
Yeah, yes. And again, that's maybe one of the interesting tensions in the film, sensitivity and sensationalism. Can you have both? I guess you can. The movie does give us a bit of both. The sensationalism overtakes it, just maybe by nature of what it is. Could a more sophisticated screenplay have handled this differently? I think so, yeah.
What would your recommendation be? Well, it's, you know, kind of crosses sci-fi, drama, you know.
Right.
A little mix of everything.
Romantic drama in outer space in part. I mean, I guess there's a genre in the making for that.
Sure.
It's a little bit of both of those things. I don't know. I mean, I found the movie to be disappointing, but I think that if you admire cast members, Ellen Burstyn, Natalie Portman, you know, John Hamm, Don Draper. I mean, it's a great bunch of people who did very well with the material that they were given.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment director of the Shepherd Express newspaper and one of our regular film contributors. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and the film Lucy in the Sky is out now.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade scars.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Cellophane flowers on yellow.